This product is rated M for mature.
For our seventh episode of the BioShock 2 podcast series, I'm sitting down with part of the AI team that has breathed life into the characters of Rapture.
I'm Matt Brown. I'm the lead AI programmer on BioShock 2. And it's my job to make sure everything works smoothly and kind of carry out the vision of the designers on the project.
My name is Kent Hudson, and I'm a senior designer on Bio 2. And I guess my job is to represent design in the AI process and handle, you know, things from the initial stages through tuning and sort of guide the meetings and all that kind of thing.
As with everyone in 2K Marin, the duo before me is again well-paired and comfortable with each other. They immediately began chatting back and forth and ribbing each other as I began asking my questions. And it's clear that they love their team and are immensely proud of the work they have created. To begin, Kent and Matt talk more in detail about what exactly AI means to 2K Marin. It is quite a general term, so I wanted to get a good base before I dug deeper into the essence of their everyday duties.
I think the thing that makes Bio interesting is that the player has a lot more verbs than they do in traditional, you know, first-person games. And so there's a lot of ground to cover just getting things like lighting guys on fire and freezing them in place and shocking them. And, you know, like the more the player can do, the more AI has to do in response because, you know, BioShock's very much about player choice and player powers and improvisational gameplay. But if the AI is not reflecting that back at you, then it's worthless. So a lot goes into simply getting sort of those responses that the player, you know, expects. And then beyond that, you know, just making them live into the world of Rapture, which I think it's sort of it's a unique problem because Rapture is such a specific environment with such specific fiction and, you know, such a specific backstory that these guys, you know, we can't just be like, hey, let's put robots in because that'd be cool. No, you can't do that. You know, it's got to be humans who have these genetic defects and, you know, it kind of puts you in a corner to where you have to be a little more creative within those constraints.
Yeah, actually, Kent kind of hit it on the head there with the player feedback. You know, really the role of the AI is to be a guinea pig for whatever the player wants to do, you know, and to kind of sell the environment and be kind of an extension of Rapture, mm-hmm. you know, selling the environment, making the player feel like what he does has meaning, you know, that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, and another thing that's tough about this kind of game is that it's less scripted than a lot of, you know, competitive games in the first person space. And so it's not like each room in the game we're like, okay, well, this one's the one where the wall breaks down, these guys run in, they take cover here, this guy says this thing, he yells, you know, whatever. It's the player can come in any way, he can be invisible when he comes in, et cetera, et cetera. And the AI just, no matter what you throw at it, has to not look dumb. And that's one of the hardest, like, that's one of the hardest things. It sounds like a low bar thing to say, but actually a lot of AI is make sure it never looks dumb. And that's really hard because there's no way to predict what's going to happen to any AI at any given time. And so it just got to handle all cases and, you know, be able to stand on its own with no designer help. Because once you enter the room, that's just code running and a player with 25 different things, you know, doing whatever the hell he wants.
It's compounded by the fact that our AIs have, you know, instead of like a tactical shooter where everybody is kind of a different kind of shooter, everybody has a gun and grenades mm-hmm. or something like that, and they all are a little different. Our different AI types are completely different. We got people, you know, climbing on ceilings, jumping off walls, you know, barreling through, grabbing stuff. And then there's, you know, normal shooting. And getting it all working in a realistic fashion is definitely a challenge.
While the idea that the goal of AI is to not make it look dumb, the comment struck me as very true. So often in games, we encounter stiff characters or inane enemies. Sometimes you just want to yell, hide behind that box already. Kent and Matt, both avid gamers, have learned a lot from the years playing shooters. They also learned a lot from the original BioShock that they wanted to expand upon.
Wow. We wanted to take as much as possible from BioShock 1. But a lot of the changes that we made were due to how we wanted the game to change. The BioShock 1, Rapture is kind of a very enclosed city, a lot of corridors and a lot of enclosed spaces, and they kind of wanted to open it up and have larger spaces, And the BioShock 1 AIs didn't handle big spaces like that very well. They didn't handle vertical, you know, vertical changes, jumps, and things like that. So a lot of the changes we made to the BioShock 1 AIs were adding, you know, new functionality in terms of cover and jumping and kind of taking advantage of the environment a little bit more. And then the other thing we did was just add new interesting things, new interesting AI types. We kind of took the idea of Rapture 10 years later and kind of blew out, you know, what would somebody undergoing a particular type of evolution over 10 years, what would they be like, and how would they fight, and how would they survive? And
they would learn how to duck behind crates.
Apparently. Yes. It takes them 10 years to learn how to duck behind cover.
While, but they got there. I think you hit a big one for me, which was just more environmental awareness. And that comes in a lot of different ways. Just, again, like Rapture being such a... you know, like kind of front character for the game. The first game, I think the AI was simple but functional and effective. Like, I actually have been replaying it recently, and it's not nearly as bad as I expected, considering how much we had added to it. I was kind of expecting to be worse, but it actually is totally functional and cool. I think they knew what they had and worked around it very well. But I think that with Bio 2, the environmental awareness of taking cover behind things, you know, low cover, high cover, being able to jump down from balconies and jump up to balconies for certain characters, you know, some of the perch point stuff we've done, which basically is a couple of our characters can jump up onto a point on the wall, then jump to somewhere else, almost like a Mario super jump kind of thing. Our brute character, who I guess we'll talk about in just a little bit, he can actually pick objects up from the world and throw it at the player. That's one of his attacks. So it's just a lot more. It seems like these people are actually in the world a lot more than they were in the first game. And, you know, it's still dudes with guns and you know, your expected type stuff from Bio 1. But, you know, just trying to maintain the personality of those characters who are really memorable in the first game and had lots of funny barks and, you know, funny lines, and just try to sort of iterate on that more than anything. Like, I think it's been very iterative with a couple of sort of big risk kind of things we've done. But overall, it's been really good.
The original BioShock had a rich and organic environment. The citizens of Rapture were going about their lives around you, until you came into their line of sight, which most certainly changed the course of their days. This living, breathing city holds true for BioShock 2, but this time around, you are a big daddy, not a mere human. Because of this, the AI team had to change the citizens' behaviors quite drastically. After all, we fought big daddies in the first game, and even spliced up. A big daddy fight was no laughing matter.
I think the thing that makes it work for us, you know, because I'm not a big, I don't like games that are very cover heavy on the player side, where you feel like, you know, run into a room and duck, run into a room and duck, run into a room and duck, you know, like that's the whole game. I think that it just makes the AI seem a lot smarter, because if a guy's standing in the middle of a room, you start shooting him, and he all of a sudden runs and ducks behind something, that just makes him seem like he's reacting to the player more, like he's more aware, like he's actually interested in preserving his own life. Which is, you know, not something that a lot of games do. I don't think we've necessarily done anything super crazy with cover that no one else has done. I mean, it's you know, guys will duck behind things that are, you know, waist height, and they'll lean out from corners and stuff like that. It all works systemically, you know, which is really nice. You can go to any side of where he is, and he'll reassess and grab new cover points. But I think mostly it's just, you know, making them feel smarter, making them feel more like they're in the world. And that's tricky, because if they feel too smart, it's not fun for the player. So you don't want them to seem as smart as the player, but you definitely do want them to at least show a little bit of interest in staying alive.
Yeah, technically there's nothing super fancy going on. I mean, there's a lot of cover systems out there, and at this point in time, you know, building cover systems is pretty well understood. I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's not necessarily a player-centric thing. It's not like the player's taking cover. It really is useful, though, because, like, the player is the big daddy. He's a big tank. And when you're fighting these little human guys, you need to give them something, you know?
Right, yeah.
You know, they're not just going to run at you anymore. So it does help kind of lend to that feel.
And it actually helps, I think, sort of tangentially balance the combat a little better, where if you had three guys in the same room in the first, you know, BioShock, there's a chance that all three of them are just going to be standing in the open just firing at you at the same time. And with guys who will move around a little bit more, take cover, and, you know, once they get in, they'll do the sort of like, you know, what do they call it? Stop and pop, or pop and shoot, or whatever. I don't know the term for it, but, you know, they'll come out of cover, give you a quick burst, and duck back down. And so if you've got three guys doing that instead, now you're kind of tracking, okay, that guy just went down, I can focus on this guy, okay, he's getting ready to come up, okay, got him, you know. So it gives you a little bit more of that that whack-a-mole type, you know, feel
pacing,
to it, which just introduces pacing and a little bit more, you know, sort of like a steady state across the combat as opposed to just a constant hose of bullets.
A cover system was just one of the many things the team tweaked, added, and perfected for BioShock 2. While I knew it would be impossible for them to remember in detail everything, I wanted to know more about some of their biggest challenges and proudest moments in the development process. Good AI can sometimes go unnoticed in the heat of battle, because, if well done, it's natural.
I think there's a lot of little things, you know, all the behaviors that our AIs do, there's lots of little things everywhere. You know, the brute has his little special behaviors, the ceiling crawlers have their cool new attacks and their perch points, and the big sister's got a whole new array. So it's a lot of little things. There's not one big, this is our AI feature of the game that we're selling, you know. AI in this game is not some big marquee, you know, thing that we're selling and put on the front of the box. It's more of support of Rapture. And so there's just a lot of little things that really help sell the AI in this game.
I think that if you look at what the big sister can do with all her different attacks, you actually could kind of market it as, you know, we have made a lot of improvements from the first game and really taken to the next level. But I think the sort of overarching theme that is coolest about the AI is that everything feels consistent within the character. And so it doesn't feel like we had an idea for, like, wouldn't it be cool if there was a character who, I don't know, controlled another character with his mind or whatever, and we tried to shoehorn it into something else. It's like the brute does some really cool stuff. He's like our big character, and he will pick up objects and actually throw them, you know, at you in the world, which doesn't sound like a lot, but when you look at other games, they either, you know, magically spawn an object in their hands and you can see it pop in. Like, our guy will actually pick something, go over, pick it up, his hands scale to it, he throws it at the player, gets back on you. It's actually really impressive, and that made sense for him. He's the, you know, human guy who's the most spliced up. He's a huge, you know, he's not, you know, mentally incapacitated, but he's definitely, you know, felt the effects of all that Adam, and he's a dumb, big, strong, brutish character. And it just made sense. It's like he's got so much strength and so much anger at the player that it's just like, yeah, if he did see a chair, he would pick it up and just throw it at you because he can. And that's just his, you know, simple attack. You know, he's not the guy who's going to flank you. He doesn't use cover. We specifically turned it off for him. You know, we could make him use cover, but why? You know, so it's very much like each character, what they do makes sense for that character. Same with the big sister. You know, she's very plasmidy. She's very, you know, agile and all those things. And even the human guys, it's not like we, you know, added a bunch of crazy stuff. It's like, no, just hide if someone's shooting at you. Take cover, you know, like it's a lot of stuff like that. And crawlers, you know, I think we made a lot of iterative improvements on them for what made sense to the character. The overall just kind of added to the richness of the whole thing.
As the team has already briefly discussed, other characters lurk in the watery shadows of Rapture beyond splicers and big daddies, namely the big sister. In past episodes, we have detailed how she was designed from concept art to final render. Now the AI team talks about how she was brought to life and gives a bit more detail on what kind of challenge you are up against when facing her.
I think that the thing with her is, because she's supposed to be sort of the ultimate boss of the game, whereas in BioShock 1, it was clearly the big daddies. I mean, not counting Fontaine at the end, which was lame. But in the levels, you know, you've got the big daddies, and that's sort of your roaming boss fight that is, you know, it's big metal characters, ton of hit points, cool tactics, etc. And so I think the challenge with the big sister was have her fill that role and be even tougher than a big daddy, but also be very different. Like, big daddies are, you know, they've got a ton of hit points, but they're kind of slow. The bouncer can charge you, but when he's not bouncing, he's fairly slow. And Rosie just, you know, shoots a rivet gun at you. The big sister, we wanted her to be tough, but also fast and feel like she's outsmarting you, and kind of tie that into, you know, sort of the overall feel of the character through the game, you know, where she's stalking you through the levels, and she, you know, you'll turn a corner and you'll see her do something cool and then dart off, and make her feel like she's this agile, smart, like predator type character in the levels. And so with her combat, we tried to, you know, make her really fast. So she's faster than I think anyone in our game and probably anyone in Bio 1. So you've really got to have full attention on her, because she's darting, she's jumping off walls, she's charging, you know, she can move so fast and move through the levels that you're sort of like hoping to keep up with her when she's moving. And then when she stops, she's super dangerous. You know, she's got a lot of different powerful attacks. So that was just really trying to sell like powerful but agile, and not necessarily this big plotting machine, but more of, you know, her character, which is she's, you know, clearly younger and she's got a lot more sort of Adam power type stuff, you know, like whereas the big daddy was just dude in a suit with guns or with, you know, the big drill in his hand. She actually can use plasmid powers against you. So she uses telekinesis. She uses like a big sort of fireball attack on you. So that gave us like a lot of leeway with kind of taking her over the top compared to the big daddies. So she's kind of more powerful. You know, she does a lot more environmental stuff. You know, she can jump up, you know, from up and down balconies. She can jump up onto a wall, kick off the wall, come back down and hit you with her needle and do all sorts of cool stuff like that. So it's just more kind of dialing it to 11 with her, which was, you know, really cool because it fits her character of just being such an important, you know, I don't want to get into story spoilers, but such an important part of the story and such an important part of the world and the narrative, you know, even outside of Rapture. So yeah, it would be really lame if she was just shooting a rivet gun at you.
That was such a beautiful salute. I don't want to end it with something that's going to be not as nice to say. Yeah, I mean, you basically hit all the good points. Persistent, you need to have something bigger than you,
right? Better than you. And this, I mean, that's a good point too. Is that I hadn't even thought of that. Of you know, you were just a human, and they were big daddies, so it makes sense that they would be more powerful. But now I'm a big daddy, and it's not that big daddies in this game aren't hard. They're still, you know, really difficult foes, and that you're, you know, they're back from Bio One, and you'll enjoy fighting them. But it's like you're a little bit more on even footing with them now, and so we want to, you know, give you something that's even higher in the food chain.
Another character has been mentioned multiple times, the Brute Splicer. Entirely new to Rapture, he is not only a formidable opponent to gamers, but also quite the project for the AI team. He is also fascinating because he is completely different from the Big Sister, and a great example of how disparate the enemies in BioShock 2 can be.
Really early on, they wanted something that was halfway between like the humans and the big daddies, and they wanted something that was kind of fast and kind of agile and quick and strong. They needed a close up melee guy, and so they started with the concept art, you know, kind of coming up with what he would look like, how he would move, and it was very much an iterative process. We got him in the game, and we're like, okay, well, what do we want this guy to do? How do we want him to fight? And then once we got the basics in, then we started playing around. Okay, well, what can we do with this? Wouldn't it be cool if he could go grab objects or if he could swat objects at you as he was running towards you? Things like that.
Yeah. I mean, when I came on, he had just gotten into the game, and in a very basic state. And I think he was just doing the melee stuff. And he was, you know, physically large and looked mean and all that stuff. And it was like, oh, that's cool. You know, nothing special to him. But he, you know, does kind of fill that role of, like you said, like halfway between the humans and the big daddies to kind of not have such a big bridge there of, you know, guys you can just burn down versus, you know, boss fights. But it's funny, too, because, like, I remember a lot of the stuff we started talking about early was I figured we couldn't do it. So I was, like, talking about things like, well, I'm sure we can't do this. Well, let me just throw an idea out there, you know. And then we started trying to do, like, oh, little cheap implementations of stuff. So maybe he would swat an object, but we just had one animation for it, and it didn't really line up. But it was kind of cool because a physics object actually flew at you and would do damage to you. And then we got him in the game really early and started doing a lot of iterative stuff. Like, we put him in a functional state where he had, like, really proxy animations that looked really bad. But we started iterating really fast on those and be like, okay, his run needs to be faster, but his punch should be slower and da-da-da and stuff like that. And got it to where he felt good to play before he looked good. So we kind of established the rhythm of that combat without a really high expense and kind of got him in and working early. So we had a lot of time to iterate. Because that's like, so much of a good game comes from getting to a point where you have a stable foundation to iterate from. Because we don't spend a lot of time doing tons of paper design on things, at least in the AI group. I mean, we start with bullet point specs and we just meet every week and just iterate. So once he got in, we just started saying, well, yeah, what if he did pick that thing up and throw it? And we got a really cheap version in. We're like, oh, wow, that's cool. Okay, what's the next problem to solve? Well, now he's got to get there a little faster. Then when he picks it up, we're going to scale his hands to match the size of the object so it looks like he's picking it up. And, oh, we've got to filter out certain objects and start putting, you know, like, and doing all the, there's a million little things that it took to get him there, you know. Each object can have its own preference weighting, so he wants to pick it up or doesn't, and, you know, there's size ranges we have to do, and there's objects that'll spawn objects for him, and he can only go so far to pick them up, and it's, you know, probably there's 100 tuning variables on him, like, literally, and it's all just, you get it in early, you start playing with it, and then you just make it better one piece at a time and keep looking at it, to the point where now, I'm really proud of how he turned out. I think the group should be as well. Like, I think he turned out really cool. And it was just all of us just, you know, looking at him every day and just, you know, making those little changes and giving ourselves enough time to get him in the game. And he turned out really cool.
Talking about the Brute really brings the guys to life. He is an excellent example to highlight the creation process of characters and the workflow of the entire AI team. And from the laughter coming from Matt and Kent, as harrowing as the challenges could be, they were also memorable.
I kept thinking of circumstances of where early on he would do silly things, you know, where, where he'd like pick up money and throw it at you.
Yeah.
and you'll be in a meeting and you're like, oh, he just threw money at me. We need to fix that.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like funny, but we can't ship that. That's the approach we took with, you know, most of our AIs is just get it in, play it in the game, in the levels, and, you know, just see how it works. And so, yeah, the Brute, really cool guy.
AI is not impervious to roadblocks, bad ideas, and failed experiments. As a game goes from concept to a box on your retailer shelf, stories shift, characters morph or disappear entirely, and all of those changes impact the AI, sometimes in a very significant way.
You talk about, you know, cutting is shipping and all those kind of things, but I can't really think of anything that's, like, huge that we were just like, look, let's punt on it. Like, I don't know. I guess the approach we took of just get, you know, decide what you want to do at a high level, get it in and start fixing the small problems and just iterating, I think sort of, you know, I guess early just led us down a reasonable path in terms of production that, you know, we did cool stuff without having to throw a lot away.
Yeah, on the Brute in particular, yeah, there wasn't much to throw away.
But yeah, we've had some stuff come from story changes that we, you know, got rid of.
Yeah, like the jumping for humans, for example. Originally, that system was designed so that you could have arbitrary, you know, types of movement. So it wasn't just jumping, but you could have, you know, shimming through a wall or crawling through a vent and things like that.
That's why they're called special anim path nodes.
Right, exactly.
For humans, it's pretty neat that they will jump down because it just makes them look a little bit more intelligent and more worthy adversaries. But with the more acrobatic characters, it's really sweet. Just seeing a crawler, like, you jump down under him and he just, you know, jumps, grabs on the wall, throws two hooks at you, then jumps down and attacks you. That's super cool.
It's also part of just making them not look stupid, you know?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
you're fighting a splicer and you happen to jump off a balcony. On bio one, they would have to go all the way to the stairs and walk down.
Yeah.
And.
Which, yeah, I mean, and again, like I said, when you say it, it sounds like, oh, yeah, you know, their AI really sucked. But in fact, it's like it worked for what they were doing.
Yeah.
So like they didn't have broken out railways or railings, and they, you know, didn't have a lot of places where the player could do that by virtue of level design. So what they did have worked for the game. And
absolutely.
So it's we have to make a lot of those same, you know, trade-offs, you know, with the limitations of our AI, because, you know, every game is going to have that. So it's sort of scaling your, you know, your content with your sort of technical abilities. As long as those two are in harmony, I think it, you know, you end up with good results.
Over the course of my chat with Kent and Matt, I began to realize that, like many of the 2K Marin teams, their process was fairly unique and most definitely collaborative. How they all worked together explained why the two were so comfortable sitting here in front of me. They were like family. And not in the way you say family because it sounds warm and fuzzy. The way these guys worked created a notable bond and a sense of trust.
When you're in pre-production, you know, we don't have anything in the game, so it's a lot of art and thinking about, you know, how
R&D
we want
stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's more like what AIs you want to have in the game. But yeah, nowadays it really is. We're meeting actually multiple times per week and just iterating, finding problems and fixing them.
Yeah, the AI group, which consists of myself from the design perspective, Matt, you know, as the AI lead, and then we have a couple more AI programmers, a handful of animators, the sound guys are kind of involved in everything. So we kind of have our sort of small little cabal, our small little group. And, you know, we meet Monday and Wednesday. We have one meeting for just the big sister to make sure she's cool. And then we have another meeting for, you know, all the other AIs. And before, you know, maybe 2 months ago, we had a meeting for every AI type weekly, twice a week, actually. So what we do is we meet on Monday and we just start playing the game, and we're just, you know, we have our producer in there as well, and we just yell out notes, and she's like, oh, he just did something weird, let's look into that. And so we basically all sit in a room, play it, brainstorm, call out, you know, things that are wrong, and then, you know, turn that into actionable items. So it's not just us sitting in a room, you know, messing around, but it's actually, we're generating our own work lists for the rest of the week. So it's like, we leave the meeting, that stuff goes in the database, we start working on that, we fixed a certain amount of it by Wednesday, we come back, we meet again, okay, that stuff's fixed, let's call it a new list. And so we sort of like are just churning through our own stuff and just generating our own notes. And it really is, you know, that's kind of been the process for a while, you know, once even, and we start that very early, like even, so, you know, we've got another character, who I guess I won't say the name of, cause I don't think it's been announced yet. But it started with a fictional sort of bio and concept. And so, okay, we're like, cool, you know, let's look at that and kind of get a feel for what that character is and what, how that character should behave in the world. You know, this kind of personality would lead to this kind of attack and this kind of movement and all those things. And then just very quickly, we made a bullet list of ideas and just roughed them in really fast and then just immediately jumped into that iterative loop instead of spending a year and a half, you know, just writing stuff out on long papers and doing technical design documents and, you know, code assessments and da-da-da-da-da. It's like even at that very early stage when it looks really bad and it's not even fun, we just get in those meetings and just start churning on our own stuff and just iterating and just being agile, you know? Because I mean, it's ultimately all you ship is what's on the screen.
We have a fantastic team. They're really good at being able to ignore what looks bad but isn't important that know we're going to get fixed. And then being able to identify even the subtle things that should be working that aren't and things like that.
Yeah.
We've got a really good team for that. You make it sound a little dry. Whenever I go in there, it feels like Mystery Science Theater 3000. Like,
yeah.
It feels like we're watching our game and then we all start like calling out, oh, look at that. Yeah. That's funny. But yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely fun and it's lighthearted, but we do, you know, like I get nervous, when people who aren't in our group sit in on a meeting because I'm like, oh God, they think we just sit here and make jokes all day. They're like,
we're pretty mean to each other too.
Yeah. we definitely crack on each other and, you know, aren't very political when we call stuff out and everything else like that. And it's like, to an outsider, it must seem like, how do these guys get anything done? But like, I guess we sort of established our own rhythm to it and our own, just our way of interacting. And like, I think the results are on the screen and I think I'm really proud of what our group did. And it's just, you know, we sit in there, we have a good time and we just call it out and then we go back to our desk and we work hard and we come back and we do it again. And that's, I think, led us to really good results. You know, a lot of times we'll just have ideas in the meetings, and be able to get something in to look at by the next one and just grind on it, you know?
And so another pairing from 2K Marin leaves me. As so often happens, I'm left with more than an informational interview that gives color to the making of Bioshock 2. And I've learned much more than what AI means for this specific game and how the team has perfected each character. That's probably my favorite part about this series and my time with the Mariners. Each group has a distinct personality that exudes excitement for the game they are creating and for their love of their team. The dev team may be working tirelessly to finish up Bioshock 2, but they are always having fun doing it. This is Elizabeth Toby, Community Manager at 2K.